Now I'll just say, yeah, the Fed has your back, all right, but there's a knife in your back and the Fed is twisting it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the message is investors better buckle up because the Fed has either over-tightened already or they're going to continue to tighten until the market goes down.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, here with a present for you all for the winter holidays. The wonderful Stephanie Palmboy returns as guest host today to interview highly respected economist David Rosenberg on his macro and market outlook for 2023. Enjoy.
Hi, this is Stephanie Palmboy. I am standing in for Adam Taggart this week. I guess, again, I didn't break anything, so he's invited me back for a third go of this, and we'll see if I can keep my winning streak going. Actually, it probably won't be hard because I've got my favorite guest ever. Mr. David Rosenberg joins us again. Dave, the last time we chatted, I went back and looked, was April, at which point the Fed had just undergone its first rate hike. So I kind of want to kick off. There's so much I want to talk to you about, obviously your outlook for 2023, but the first thing I really wanted to focus on with you is to get your take on not just what the Fed's done this year, but this latest press conference and where we're going to go. I'm going to share with you my bewilderment and see if you have an answer. First, I'll confess that I never thought the Fed would tighten as aggressively as they have when this year began. And that said, here we are now, and they've raised 400 basis points since you and I spoke in April. And the economic data, I would say, have clearly weakened dramatically. And anyone with a spreadsheet can basically do the math on the inflation numbers and figure out that if we keep up the current run rate on inflation, the Fed will hit its target by June of next year. Mm-hmm. At the same time, even the staff at the Federal Reserve are now starting to figure out that this payroll employment number that they've been myopically focused on as signaling tightness in the labor market is massively overstating strength in the labor market. So it's twin mandates, inflation and employment, look like they're substantially weaker than currently presented, and they're decelerating rapidly, which kind of leads me to puzzle as to why Powell sounded so incredibly hawkish in his presser. And, you know, I have my own pet thesis on it, but I'd really be keen to get your thoughts on what is the Fed thinking?
Well, first, Stephanie, thanks for having me back on. I didn't know so much time had lapsed. And if I'm your favorite guest, then by definition, you're my favorite host.
Oh.
You know, you refer to me as Mr. David Rosenberg, but only my kids call me that. You can call me Rosie.
Okay, I'll call you.
But the last name is not Scenario. Okay, all kidding aside. So, look. You said that both you and I didn't think that the Fed was going to go as far as it has in such a short time period. But then again, neither did the Fed, because when you go to the dots of a year ago, December 2021, the median dot plot was 0.9% for where we are now, not 4+. So I think that the Fed even surprised itself. And I guess in answer to the question, you know, firstly, when the Fed first started raising interest rates and understanding that the most pithy quote of all time didn't come from an economist, it came from a Nobel laureate physicist named Albert Einstein, who famously said that the power of compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. So started writing about, well, we are into a new Fed cycle, and tightening cycles are different than easing cycles, and that every easing cycle ultimately precipitated the conditions for economic revival and renewal. Not necessarily every Fed tightening cycle leads to recession, But if we're playing the odds, what I said was that there is an 80% chance we have a recession. That's the historical record since 1950. And there's a 20% chance of there being a soft landing where the economy slows down but doesn't reverse course. And we had that in the mid-1960s, the mid-80s, and then, of course, in the mid-90s, which then all of a sudden Alan Greenspan takes on the moniker of the maestro. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in this business, you know, we always say there's nothing that's 0%, nothing that's 100%. It's all shades of gray. But like portfolio managers that you and I advise, they're always playing probabilities. And that's what we have to do. So I said, look, 80% of the time we have a recession. We'll keep an open mind as to whether or not this could be, as low as the odds are, a soft landing, that the Fed just gets it perfect. But then they inverted the yield curve. They've kept on tightening into the inverted yield curve. And I did say that, you know, economists are going to come out and say, as they always do, to fade the yield curve. Even the Fed said fade the yield curve. And then Jay Powell constructed his own special yield curve, which is now, by the way, inverted, but he doesn't talk about it. And so when the Fed tightens into a yield curve inversion, the odds of a recession go up above 90%. And then, of course, now we have a situation where they've continued to tighten into the most inverted yield curve since the summer and fall of 1981. And so all of a sudden, the odds, therefore, go up to 100%. In fact, you know, we know that the I don't even know if I'm going to talk me and you out of business. Who needs an economist when we have the conference board's leading indicator? Which is a hodgepodge of market signals and capital goods orders and building permits and so on and so forth. It has a perfect track record back to 1959 in predicting expansions and recessions. And under this particular condition, which is that the LEI has gone down now for 8 straight months, the decline is almost 6% at an annual rate. And when you go back historically, when you have that condition, we've actually had a recession 1 or 2 quarters out 100% of the time. So I guess I'll backtrack and say, well, maybe sometimes it is black and white and the recession is already baked in the cake and is going to be next year's story. Unless you want to say it's different this time and we should ignore just about everything pointing to a recession, but to ignore this pernicious and pronounced decline in the leading indicator, I think would be irresponsible, if not dangerous. So, look, the Fed has told us that it wants to get inflation down to target as quickly as possible. I think their big concern is that the longer inflation stays elevated, the greater the risk that inflation expectations become unmoored. Although there's no evidence anywhere that there's been anything close to a wage price spiral, to them, that's a risk. And I would just say that from the Fed's perspective, what's worse for the Fed, a recession or inflation? And I'd say probably inflation, because their responsibility ultimately is the purchasing power of the country and price stability, however you want to define it. I sort of pitied Jay Powell at the beginning of the year. You know, you had people like Larry Summers and Bill Dudley and Mohammed El-Erian. And I mean, everybody is comparing poor Jay Powell to, you know, to Arthur Burns and in the central banking business. And actually, it's an unfair comparison because Arthur Burns was an economic genius. He was the mentor to Alan Greenspan. But he buckled under pressure and had a nervous breakdown because of the relentless strains from Richard Nixon. Powell hasn't had that political constraint. In fact, Joe Biden was getting blamed for all the inflation earlier this year and gave the Fed the green light. And so I say, look, you don't want to get compared to Arthur Burns. He wants to get compared to Paul Volcker. And I remember that back in March, in a back and forth, right when they started actually raising interest rates at the what we used to call the Humphrey Hawkins testimony, the semi-annual congressional testimony, in a back and forth with Alabama Senator Richard Shelby, and a back and forth, Jay Powell continuously compared himself to Paul Volcker. Well, we know that the Fed has the tools to create recessions and destroy inflation. And Paul Volcker basically did that. He killed the economy back-to-back recessions. What people don't realize, of course, is that the greatest inflation dragon slayer of all time ultimately became in 1982 and 83 the biggest interest rate slayer of all time, because Paul Volcker cut the funds rate 1,200 basis points in short order after the inflation dragon was slain, and generated the recession to do that. And then the next thing you know, he's only remembered for almost 20 years of uninterrupted economic expansion and a bull market outside of the October 87 collapse, which is now a speck of a dot on the Ibbotson chart.
Yeah.
So I'd say that, you know, is the Fed making a policy mistake? Well, if their goal is to generate a recession, well, then the answer is that there's no mistake. This is what's actually what they want. And when you go to their latest set of forecasts, they're calling for the unemployment rate to go to 4.6%. So I have my clients tell me, well, 4.6%, big deal. That's still a low unemployment rate. You know, without realizing that by the time you're at 4.6%, you know, by the time you're up more than a percentage point in the unemployment rate, because it's the move, it's not the level that matters.
Right.
Because we're talking about growth in the economy. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about levels of GDP. GDP is always at a high level. Even in the Great Recession, GDP was at a high level. It's about the rate of change, and the rate of change in the economy will move with the rate of change in the unemployment rate. And we've never not had a recession with the unemployment rate going up above more than one percentage point. In fact, the median and the average is closer to 0.6% of an increase. The bottom line here is that, and this is what the Fed's telling you, is that going to 4.6% is going to mean at least 1.5 million jobs lost, depending on what you're assuming on the labor force participation rate. Now, that's not the end of the world, but it's not going to make those 1.5 to 2 million people very happy. By the time you get to 4.6%, looking at the historical record, we're going to be in the fourth or fifth month of the recession. But I think this is what the Fed wants. Like, what did Powell tell us at Jackson Hole? I'm going to have to, I'm going to have to inflict pain on the household and business sector. So,
well, what worries me,
that pain is a very good word. He could have just said recession. Jerry Ford, you know, didn't want to use either. He just said banana. Back in the 70s. So, but I think that it's unnecessary. And when I started getting really edgy, Stephanie, was when Powell told us back in March when they started raising rates, and he said this at the press conference, that the Fed was going to turn a blind eye to the supply side of the economy. And I guess it's a classic case of once burnt, twice shy, that, you know, China shut down again. We had the Omicron, the impact that had on the female labor force participation rate, you know, more in the way of global supply chain problems. And the Fed just said, you know, enough is enough. So you and I both went to economics school, where they taught us in our first course that the only way you can predict prices and inflation, of course, is the rate of change in the aggregate price level. You need to have two curves, supply and demand. So I'm there thinking, well, how is the central bank going to be able to forecast inflation by focusing on one curve? Because they're saying we are not going to be relying on any easing on the supply side. And here, what do you know? Perfect timing. You see the global supply bottlenecks are starting to ease, global freight rates, commodity prices are off their highs. It's so obvious that the supply side, you look at the order backlogs and the vendor delivery delays, completely different picture.
Yeah.
And the demand side is, of course, going to contract at the same time that we're seeing a different shape to the supply curve than we did this time last year. I think the conditions are set here for big, big disinflation, if not deflation, next year.
Well, that kind of
And then the Fed is just going to reverse course again. So basically, look, Stephanie, it's a, you know, you and I were laughing when we heard Ben Bernanke talk about in 06 that the problems of subprime will remain contained. And
right.
We're going nationwide. And then back in 2000, Alan Greenspan is telling us that the tech wreck is just an inventory overhang correction. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, in 2001, oops, it's actually a detonation of the technology capital stock and deflationary. And, you know, we could just roll back each cycle. So, look, that's the reality. Interest rate cycles and market cycles, economic cycles, just the centrifugal forces that are like sine waves that just interconnect with each other time and again. They just look like these recurring waves. Yeah. And so is it a policy mistake? Well, you know, it all depends. Was this ultimately, we won't know until we get the FOMC transcripts 5 years from now as to whether or not this was a deliberate attempt, not just to cool off the economy, but generate a demand destruction. Demand destruction is negative GDP, to get the Fed much more quickly towards the 2% target. Right. And so it's a grim reality. It's a grim outlook. It's not a perpetual outlook, but certainly for the coming year, that's what we should expect.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I worry about, and I suspect you share this concern, is that in contrast to his, mentor Volcker, Powell is raising rates in unprecedented fashion on an economy that's toting substantially more leverage. So he's basically conducting this experiment by pushing through the fastest rate hikes on an economy and a financial system with enormous amount of visible leverage, but also layers of invisible leverage, where you see things like crypto and SPACs and all of these FTX just suddenly evaporating. And there's all these tentacles that I don't think he is aware of or can have any ability to quantify. You'll only quantify, as Greenspan said, we won't know if it was a bubble until after it bursts. So what I worry about is, I appreciate this belated integrity on the part of the Federal Reserve to suddenly, okay, we've got to rein in this reckless stimulus that was both monetary and fiscal during the COVID era. But what they're trying to do is slay a COVID era dragon, but maybe oblivious to the fact that these excesses have been built up, not just in the last 2 years, but in the 20 years, 30 years that they've been, inculcating this Fed put and encouraging continued leverage. And as you said, the obvious thing that's going to happen is they're going to go too far and then they'll reverse. And that's the market psychology. In fact, when you look at the futures, Fed funds futures market, going into the FOMC statement and then the presser, and then after, they didn't change. Expectations are still, Fed funds rate will peak around 4.8, and then they'll be cutting rates immediately thereafter. And that'll be sometime, in the back half of next year. So the markets still believe in that put, which has to stand as a real obstacle to the Fed. It seems to me like what Powell's trying to do is remove the put. I mean, I suspect, he must be aware of the economic data and how weak it is and the math on the inflation numbers. Is he basically trying to say, I'm the anti-Greenspan? Greenspan installed the put and it was reinforced for decades. And I'm going to be the guy that says, no, you can no longer count on the Fed to rush in with the fire hoses every time there's a problem.
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And then we have to take a look at Jay Powell and who he really is. So, of course, they pivoted in 2019, that was amidst a crisis in their own backyard, which is when the repo market blew up. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we got to start talking about the Powell pivot. And then, of course, look at everything he did in 2020. Then again, we thought that this might be the bubonic plague. It wasn't.
Yeah.
But the extreme expansion of the balance sheet, zero rates, opening up the Fed's kimono to include, non-investment grade bonds, and they continued to buy mortgages into the early part of this year, even though the housing market was clearly entering into a price bubble. So I think that this is partly for Powell to, shed those feathers that he's some sort of softy, viewed as buckling under pressure to Trump in 2019, rampant easing and almost sounding like a social worker in 2020 and a good chunk of 2021. But if you go back to the FOMC meeting transcripts so that you can understand what it is that I do for fun, and really just because I have trouble sleeping, so this is actually a big help. But He became governor in 2012. And when you go back and read the FOMC transcripts, which actually they are always a great read. It's like a Shakespearean it's tragedy. You see that Powell is a hawk, like a Jeremy Stein hawk, you know, like a Randy Quarles hawk, a Richard Fisher hawk, and was really pressing hard against, you know, everything that Bernanke wanted to do in terms of extending QE, all those years of interest rates bouncing along the bottom, even as the economy was recovering. And remember that Powell became governor was already, you know, more than 2 years after the worst point of the Great Recession. So he is a hawk. He was always complaining about how the Fed's policies through that entire period that went right into Janet Yellen were fostering financial market imbalances and excesses and too much risk taking. So if you want to get to know the real Powell, you have to go back and read those transcripts, or you can read the very few speeches that he gave in that time period. The guy is not a puffball. If the comparison to Arthur Burns was that, well, he is going to let the inflation genie out of the bottle, that was never going to happen, despite the fact that he clearly was very patient. I actually just think that what the Fed should have done all along was put some sort of definition to the term transitory, which is timeless. But as we both know, if we can talk about in the overall annals of economic history, 18 months is actually pretty temporary.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm making is what you just said. And it's interesting because after Jackson Hole, when he was hawkish and the market, stock market started going down, I think it was Neil Kashkari from Minneapolis, who was Uber Dove, came right out and said something I don't think I've ever heard. I've heard a Fed official talk about the stock market was Alan Greenspan back in 1996 when he dared to mention irrational exuberance. And he posed it as a question. And then he just got, you know, the negative press he got on that was incredible. But Neil Kashkari comes out and says that we were not happy with how the stock market reacted to what Powell said back in July, and the market ripped because they thought there was some pause coming. Mm-hmm. And Kashkari says, we're very happy now the stock market's going down.
Yeah,
the Fed wants the stock market to go down. They want financial conditions to tighten. But I think that when I look back to the real Jay Powell, will the real Jay Powell please step forward? You got to go back to those transcripts and you'll see that he believes there is a dangerously extreme link between Wall Street and Main Street, between the financial economy and the real economy. And we went into 2022 with a bigger equity bubble and housing bubble than we had back in 2006, 2007. And so I think that what he's doing is not even Paul Volcker. He's doing a McChesney Martin, a Martin-like, and Martin famously said in a speech to a banking conference, of all things, in 1955, that the Fed is the chaperone taking the punch bowl away early at the party. The problem this time around, of course, is that Powell pulled the punch bowl as everybody was pissed drunk at 3 a.m. You can't cry over spilt milk. But I think that there's part of this that the Fed wants to end this era of Pavlov's dog, that whenever the Fed just gives a twitch of the nose, that investors go hog wild.
Yeah. When you're parsing words in a statement, it's just ridiculous. When they're worrying and looking to see if they take out the word ongoing, because that will have some enormous implications for their.
I think that there's I guess method behind their madness, and I think that I think it's frustrating for them that every single move or nuance or syllable creates these gyrations. I think actually that the day they're going to be comfortable cutting rates or pausing is when they indicate it and the market doesn't care.
Yes.
So I think they're trying to take the punch bowl away, break this link, get the markets back to focus on fundamentals as opposed to Fed pause or Fed pivot. So I think they find that frustrating because the problem for them is that the minute that they, in today's ridiculous hyperventilating marketplace. Their big fear is that they're going to give a hint. They you know, in all honesty, they probably do want to pause. They probably feel maybe we've overdone it. But then their big fear is that once we give that signal, the markets are going to surge.
Yeah.
Financial conditions are going to loosen up.
And all their work will be undone.
And then they got to start sounding hawkish again because it's not what they want. And so they're in some ways caught in a box. But it's really, in my opinion, up to, I'd say, up to the stock market to decide when is enough enough. When are you going to go back and focus on the fundamentals, earnings, valuations, if you want to focus on technicals, fund flows, market positioning, and not focus so much on the Fed. I'll just tell you right now, I mean, the Fed has always mattered. And the financial economy and the real economy are, they're always going to have a symbiotic relationship. We're a credit market determined economy, but it's gone to a ridiculous extreme. And I guess you could say, well, did the Fed reinforce that back in 2020 into 2021? Well, they probably did because there was no moral suasion or no verbiage out of the Fed. You know, they must have known back in 2020 post-March, market just takes off. And it's about FOMO, fear of missing out, TINA, there is no alternative. Oh, and the Fed has your back at all times. Now I'll just say, yeah, the Fed has your back, all right, but there's a knife in your back and the Fed is twisting it. But I would say that that's the box. The Fed is boxed in because of the market's hyper reaction to anything that they might indicate. So they don't want financial conditions to loosen right now. So they're sort of, like I said, they're sort of caught in the box. I fully agree with everything that you said. I think that they've over tightened. I think we're going to get a recession. I think the recession was unnecessary. Some people will disagree and say, well, it's the only way we'll get inflation down. I don't necessarily agree with that. But, you know, like I said, we can't cry over spilt milk. These are the cards that have been dealt. This is the tightest monetary policy since the Volcker era. So my recommendation is then to treat the landscape, let's take it a year at a time, as if this is like a Volcker-type landscape. Mm-hmm. Remember, you mentioned about the Powell put. Well, the Volcker put was eight multiple in August 1982.
Huh.
If you want to draw those sorts of comparisons, I don't think we're going to an eight multiple, but be that as it may, we have to be braced now. Now, after what the Fed has already done, and we can criticize the Fed left, right, and center, and they feel that they will be graded in the end, not by what the economy does, but what inflation does. I think they will claim victory, even if, let's face it, Paul Volcker goes down as the dean of central banking, right? But he was vilified and then vindicated. But he was vilified in the early 1980s. There were burning effigies outside of in Washington, outside of the Fed offices. And Donald Reagan, who was Ronald Reagan's Treasury Secretary, and of course, formerly CEO of my alma mater, Merrill Lynch, was in Ronald Reagan's office every day in the early 80s, wanting to get Paul Volcker fired. So nobody remembers Paul Volcker for a three-year ugly bear market in equities, and nobody remembers the fact that he created the conditions for a doubling in the unemployment rate back then and a back-to-back recession separated a year apart.
Right.
They just remember that he killed inflation. And so I would say that if Jay Powell can finish this last term and be compared to Paul Volcker, that he will be remembered for crushing inflation at any cost.
Yeah.
I think he'll grab that. In the interim, what lies ahead for next year is a recession and a rolling bear market in equities.
Yeah, I mean, that's the message is investors better buckle up because the Fed has either over-tightened already or they're gonna continue to tighten until the market goes down. I guess it's sort of interesting because as you laid out, you know, the market, every time it rallies, it forces the Fed to be more tight. And conversely, investors have to figure out that the decline in the market is the necessary condition for the stimulus that they want so badly. So, you know, it's this kind of Mexican standoff, as it were. But the interesting thing, too, to consider, you know, we're up 10,000 feet up in the sky looking at all of this, but there are some mechanical practicalities related to what the Fed's doing that might come to bear much sooner, like the unwind of the balance sheet, most notably. You know, we obviously have had a long period where foreign central banks have slowly decreased their purchases of our paper. And that has, you know, serendipitously been masked over the last few years by the Fed's massive QE purchases. Now we've got even Republicans on board with another trillion plus stimulus plan. So the deficit spending isn't going to go away. You know, it's clearly they're just going to keep pumping money into this economy, which again makes the Fed's job even harder. But how do they navigate that unwind of the balance sheet where, going back to the supply demand curves, if you're issuing more supply and demand is receding, seems like that gets resolved through price, which only compounds the downturn in the economy and the strain on the markets. What do you think happens with that? Do they pause QT, or is that not really a pressing concern in your analysis?
Well, look, you can build a scenario where they pause QT and then do QE again at some point. And of course, will they be cutting interest rates again? Absolutely. And we're getting to the very tail end of this tightening cycle. And so it's situational. It'll depend on what is happening with inflation and what's happening with the economy. They're unwinding their balance sheet, mostly, say, through treasuries. Treasury yields magically in this process have come down from almost 4.5% on the 10-year down to, say, 360. There's been a very impressive reversal in treasury yields just over the past few months. And it's very complex when you're talking about forecasting treasury yields from a flow of funds perspective, because there's such a myriad of buyers and sellers. The Fed right now is a seller. However, when inflation comes down and when the economy goes into recession, there always is a flight to safety. Mm-hmm. There's always a rebalancing from cyclical assets towards defensive assets and liquid assets. And that means the treasury market. So what happens in a recession is that credit demands go down. The banks are left with excess deposits. They put that to work, not through lending, because in a recession, when there's credit defaults, they're issuing less loans to the private sector, but they're shifting their assets. I'm talking about the commercial banks towards treasuries, pension funds, insurance companies, mutual funds. When they see the whites of the eyes of the disinflation, will naturally move towards treasuries, which are the perfect hedge against disinflation. Yes. And they will extend duration. Even in that god-awful period of the 1970s where we had, quote, stagflation, we had three recessions separated a decade apart, 1970, 73 to 75, then heading into 1980. And I'll tell you that despite elevated inflation, treasury yields went down and went down a lot, because that's what recessions do. They precipitate a shift from stocks to bonds. And even in those periods of stagflation, recessions do kill inflation. Will it kill inflation permanently? Well, we won't know that for several years. All the other things taking place, the shortage of labor, the so-called deglobalization, which, by the way, Martin Wolf addressed very well in the Financial Times in today's edition. But let's worry about the long-term effects and take this a year at a time. Inflation is going to come down a lot. And treasury yields will come down. The question is really, in my opinion, by how much. But there's naturally always a tilt towards safety and duration in a disinflationary environment. And I think that's what we're going to get next year. Now, everything you're telling me might limit the declines in treasury yields insofar as the Fed is a seller. Now, all central banks are engaging in some form of quantitative tightening. That much is true. But there's a double-edged sword in QT, which is, remember, quantitative easing was never aimed really at stimulating the bond market. It was really aimed at stimulating the stock market. And when the Fed embarked on QE2 under Ben Bernanke in 2010, the day they did it, he planted an editorial of his own in the Washington Post, where he talked about the necessity of the Fed to use quantitative easing to generate a wealth effect on spending. Well, the wealth effect is code for the stock market. Well, there are times when the stock market and bond market are negatively correlated, like it's finally starting right now. And so what that means is that the QT is really aimed at tightening financial conditions, which means lower equity prices, wider credit spreads. Treasuries should normally rally in a risk-off environment. Quantitative tightening is aimed at generating a risk-off environment. So yeah, in a static world, you'd say, well, but they're reducing, you know, their portfolio of treasuries. In a static world, that's negative for the treasury market indeed. But there's offsetting factors, mm-hmm. which is that it generates the sort of market we have right now. The stock market's been wobbly, mm-hmm. the odd bear market rally, but it's on a downward sloping trajectory. And it will push people into the relative safety of treasuries. And that really just, that trade just started in the past couple of months. And, yeah. and that'll be continuing through next year, in my opinion.
Do you think that the dollar enjoys that same flight to safety bid? Or what is your view on the outlook for the dollar for the next year?
Well, you know, the dollar is a, it's like any other exchange rate. It's a pair trade. I think what you're finding is that other central banks are starting to play catch up to the Fed. So the ECB playing catch up to the Fed. The Bank of Japan is not doing anything with traditional policy, but we saw them double the cap on the 10-year JGB yield. And you could see right away how the yen responded because interest rate differentials matter. And I think that they are going to weigh against the U.S. dollar in the coming year. It's not going to be a collapse in the dollar. It's just going to be that dollar had a couple of years of a ripping bull market. I mean, there was one point at the peak, say this summer, where the DXY, the trade weighted index, was up 15% year over year. 15% year over year. There's like five other times in history as that happened. So, you know, you had massive net speculative long positions on the Intercontinental Exchange. It was really one of the most overcrowded trades was the long US dollar trade. But what's changing at the margin is that the Fed's going to be done. Probably, I think they have one more to go at the beginning of next year. And then these other central banks are going to continue with a lag. Interest rate differentials will continue to weigh against the US dollar. So I think my favorite currency, Stephanie, is gold.
Gold, I'm with you.
Gold. I think, like I said, my highest conviction trade is the bond bullion barbell, because I love alliterations, mm-hmm. and bonds mm-hmm. are the best hedge against disinflation, which we will see. The question is how much. It's all moving in that direction, and gold is the best hedge against a declining U.S. dollar. So
that's great news for me, because that's my portfolio right there.
I guess that's why I'm your favorite guest.
I was just going to say, I knew there was a reason I loved you. So. Gosh. All kidding aside, you know, expanding the lens a little bit, when you look at 2023 and you have to advise clients on how to position, and I, like me, I'm sure a lot of your clients don't have the luxury of necessarily not owning any stocks or holding a lot of cash or gold, but they actually need to be invested in, you know, the equity markets, both, you know, in the US and globally. Mm. What do you advise them? What are there sectors or regions that they can overweight? Or what, is there anything that looks compelling right here? Or is it really just preservation of capital mode?
Well, it all depends whether or not you are a absolute return manager or a relative return manager. Mm-hmm. So in a relative world, I probably, respecting the fact that you have so much more valuation support in the emerging market world and emerging Asia, I mean, you're putting your life in your hands that things in China will go right. But I would say that if I had to be in the equity market globally, I think the emerging markets just have just a much better valuation cushion. First point I would make. And if the dollar goes down, that actually helps breed liquidity into that part of the world. So, but, you know, equity markets, you know, generally speaking, region to region, they're all correlated with each other. All these markets are correlated. So as an asset class, I think we're still in a bear market in equities. Relative value, if I had to be my back against the wall regionally, I'd be in emerging Asia. In terms of, say, where I'd be in the equity market, if I had to be in the equity market of the United States, I think I'd want to be in the sectors that have the lowest correlation with GDP because we're going into recession. So, you know, whether that's staples or healthcare or utilities, and of course you could argue that those multiples are inflated, but of course they get inflated because that's where you want to be in a recession. So it's basically just running your screens on sectors or companies, on balance sheets, cash positions, correlations with the economic cycle. And the more defensively positioned, the better. Companies that are not cyclical, that have a history of dividend payouts, you know, through good times and bad, perfectly appropriate. I'd say that within the fixed income space, I think that we have a unusual event. I know we can sit here and debate the yield curve and is it a recession predictor. I think it's actually better than most economists, and I find that the economists that actually say on television, I ignore the yield curve. The yield curve has a better track record than they do, and I know these people. But I'd say that the yield curve is a 1 to 2 standard deviation event. I mean, an inversion is not normal. Inversion is not a negative 60 or 70 basis point spread between 2s and 10s is not normal, and it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So the yield curve can only ultimately say mean revert by the short end going down in yield, which will require Fed easing, which I think is going to come, as you said, in the second half of next year, or we're going to get some massive inflation scare again, and the long end is going to sell off. This is not a normal yield curve. You know, there's nothing more that I'd love than to talk to investors about 1 to 2 SD events. What is abnormal? The yield curve is going to normalize. I think that you can buy a laddered approach to treasuries. If you want to go long the front end, do that. I think the biggest bang for the buck, total return wise, because of the convexity, will be just buying the 30-year or buying the 30-year strip. If you have, well, in Canada, we say if you have ice wine in your veins, but I think that's how I'd want to play it there. I'd want to pick your spots. I mean, the corporate credit market looks much more attractive to me on a relative yield basis. The market for corporate credit, and I'm not talking about private, okay? I see trouble there. Lots of leverage. I'm talking about the public market for debt. Double B, triple B, crossover credits, some nice yields there. You want to pick your spot. I think actually in another barbell, I'd say I want to be shorter duration. We're going into a default cycle. You know, people say to me all the time, oh, but the default rate is so low. It's like I hear, oh, the unemployment rate is so low.
Right.
Look, the default rate is low, but what you have to do is you've got to look at what's the root. What is the root of the default rate? Once the default rate starts to go up, it's too late. You've got to start taking a look at what is in arrears, the late payment rates, 30 days past due. And I'm looking at mortgages. I'm looking at auto loans. I'm looking at credit cards, and the late payment rates are hooking up, and that leads to defaults. So I want to be short duration in the corporate credit portfolio, barbelled against a long duration treasury portfolio. That to me is totally acceptable. So I'm not saying you have to be in cash, but I do think that with a high degree of certainty, and this people think this is a big call, I think that we're going to go to new lows in the S&P 500. So maybe whatever it is you do, like basically what I say, like defense, aerospace, no brainer, military budgets are going up everywhere. By the way, even in pacifist Japan, you talked about spending. A lot of the spending is going to the Pentagon. I think that is actually growth is defense expenditures, anything that's food related. Okay. I'm still actually bullish on energy. There's places that you can put money to work, but whatever I do in the equity market, and I think, again, it's very interesting that active investing is now outperforming passive investing by the widest margin since 2007. Funny enough, that was the peak of the cycle. But I'd say that you want to hedge that, maybe hedge it with a short position on the S&P 500. You see, what I'm trying to say here is that arithmetically, there's not a snowball's chance in hell. Now, I said before, there's no such thing as zero or 100, but I'm just trying to explain to people that, firstly, stock markets bottom 70% of the way into the Fed easing cycle and 70% of the way into the recession. Well, this recession is just getting going, and the Fed hasn't even started easing yet. Right. You see, basically, the stock market bottoms, you know, like it did in, for example, March of 2009. The recession ended in June of 2009. You know, it was you're basically well in when the market sees the whites of the eyes of the recovery, you want to hop in with both feet. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the recession is just starting. That might be late 2023. Plus, it's not just, you see, what has me concerned, it's got to have the Fed concerned. They're going to signal a pause, market's going to rip. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to cut rates, markets are going to rip. But it's going to be a sucker's rally. And it always is a sucker's rally. I'll tell you, go back to the last number of cycles, when the Fed pauses, markets rip. I remember when the Fed cut rates, I think for the first time, it was in August of 2007. I was at my desk. I had to order in pizza for lunch. I never left my office. The market ripped like 5% that day. And we all know with perfect hindsight that the market actually bottomed in March of 2009. So the market bottoms, when I say 70% of the way into the Fed easing cycle, that's duration. But what's the action is when the twos tens curve, you just had a friend walk into your office.
Yes, that's it's probably lunchtime. So
dog's lunch, yeah. Dog's breakfast. So usually the Fed is eased enough. You see, the market also bottoms late in the Fed easing cycle, not the beginning. That's why I'm warning everybody. You know, you can trade. If you think you're Paul Tudor Jones, trade the market. But if we're talking about the fundamental lows, it happens when that 2-10 spread is plus 140 basis points. And that's both a mean and a median. And where are we now? Like, you know, minus 50, minus 60. At one point, we were minus 80. So, you know, we're not there yet. I get questions all the time. Look, Stephanie, you too, every single day, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I have to say to people, and it's a big tongue in cheek, that I'll, you know how I'll know when we're there is when I stop asking questions, are we there yet? That's when I'll know. So that's basically it. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is, what about the equity risk premium?
Stephanie's interview with David will continue over in part 2, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as the little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button as well while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview between Stephanie and David for free, just go to wealthion.com/AdamsNotes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook that David and Stephanie have detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that David has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part 2 of Stephanie Pomboy's interview with David Rosenberg.